was somewhat demoralized because I thought, boy, if he really believes this stuff, he has, you know, lost contact he's become detached from reality if he really believes this stuff. On the other hand, you know, when I went into this and would, you know, tell him how crazy some of these allegations were, there was never an indication of interest in what the actual facts were.
Former Attorney General William Barr, in a deposition video played earlier today, day two of the January 6th hearings. Today's focus, how President Trump and members of his team perpetuated the lie that the election was stolen. We're going to talk about what new revelations came out of today's hearing, plus what's happening to some of the players involved on the outside, like Rudy Giuliani, Trump's personal lawyer, with our legal Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School. She is with us most Mondays. Hi.
Hi.
All right. That's a pretty remarkable assessment from one of his former top lieutenants that Trump may have been detached from reality. What did you make of that?
You know, maybe this is a contrarian perspective, but I actually thought it was the one moment when we didn't hear a completely consistent narrative from the committee that, of course, President Trump knew. And so what I heard this morning was a lot of Republican lawyers and campaign advisors saying, I told the president there was no basis for this. There was no basis in reality. There was this team normal that was based in reason and fact. And then there was this team abnormal, which is essentially Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell. And it was the one moment where I heard somebody say, maybe he did believe this, which I don't think would be fatal to any sort of charges that might be brought against the president. But one thing I think the committee is trying to show and has shown is that, of course, the president knew when he was saying the election was stolen. Of course, the president knew when he was trying to fundraise for litigation claiming the election was stolen, that it in fact was not.
Right. So they're trying to prove intent, right? That he knew better and yet went ahead with this. But then Barr saying perhaps he might have been detached from reality may give the president, the former president, an out.
I think the may being really key there. I do not think that this is fatal to a claim that former President Trump had awareness because he was told time and time again from so many different people, including, for instance, federal judges who he appointed, there is no there with respect to these legal claims or these political claims. And we know from having talked about President Trump and his potential legal liability for years now, that one of his defenses was, well, I didn't know, or I believe that. It was the one moment where, again, I heard somebody say, wow, if he believed that, that is remarkable. But again, it would take away that level of awareness. Because the rest of the testimony has been so consistent, I don't think that it would be fatal or would undermine any, again, potential criminal charges that could be brought.
Okay, let's listen to another clip. This is Liz Cheney, the senior Republican on the committee, from today's hearing.
President Trump rejected the advice of his campaign experts on election night and instead followed the course recommended by an apparently inebriated Rudy Giuliani to just claim he won and insist that the vote counting stop, to falsely claim everything was fraudulent.
Okay, that's a new piece of information, that Rudy Giuliani was apparently inebriated. So as you said earlier, there was Team Normal and then there was Giuliani's team. What was going on as the committee described it on election night?
So, and I mean, who's going to write this screenplay with the inebriated Rudy Giuliani kind of walking around the residence saying, here's what we're going to do. You're going to go out there and say, we won the election. All evidence, you know, to the contrary, as the narrator explains. So what are we hearing there? I think, again, the consistent narrative of former President Trump being told, you will lose. Do not go out there and claim victory. Do not go out there and claim that there's massive voter fraud. And him specifically saying, no, I'm going in a different direction, and basically looking around the room to see who can provide guidance for that different direction. It's Rudy Giuliani with one or two drinks in his hand saying, here's what we're going to do. Just claim victory. And again, it's that division that I think we all suspected existed between many of former President Trump's advisors, both political and legal, saying it's time to stop. And then this other wing of advisors saying, let's keep pushing this fraud.
So meanwhile, Giuliani has had his law license in New York suspended, also in D.C., a temporary suspension. What's happening there?
So there was a complaint brought against Rudy Giuliani on Friday by the D.C. office that basically oversees oversees attorneys and oversees rules that provide that attorneys shouldn't do things like file frivolous lawsuits with no basis in law or fact, or do anything that would impede justice. And those are the two rules that are at issue in that filing. And what they're saying here is very consistent with the claims that were made in New York successfully, which is that Rudy Giuliani acted in a way that is not just unbecoming and immoral, but it actually transgresses the rules, the professional rules of responsibility that are applicable to lawyers. And that particular claim in DC focuses on filings that he made in federal court regarding the Pennsylvania case. And Madeline, I think you and I talked about this right after the election when there were all these filings for the post-election litigation. And we basically came to the conclusion, this isn't what you teach in election law. It's what you teach in ethical lawyering and professional responsibility. And we're seeing that play out here.
Right. The claim debunked that there were more votes than voters tabulated in Philadelphia. That was roundly debunked, yet they clung to that. The committee also discussed money and money that was raised by Trump and his team after Election Day. And they set up a fundraising apparatus called the Official Election Defense Fund. Here's Zoe Lofgren, a Northern California Democrat who is on the committee.
The Trump campaign used these false claims of election fraud to raise hundreds of millions of dollars from supporters who were told their donations were for the legal fight in the courts. But the Trump campaign didn't use the money for that. The big lie was also a big ripoff.
And then the committee detailed where some of that money went. And apparently there was no such thing as the Official Election Defense Fund. What does this mean in terms of election law?
So we have a couple of questions here. One is, what exactly were people told when they were asked for donations? Not just, hey, you should get just kind of general puffing. Hey, you should give to this. We're trying to right the election. But what were the specifics in terms of what were they told and where were they told the money would be used? We could have potential campaign finance violations. And it goes to this theme that I think the committee is also trying to show, which is that President Trump was lying to a couple of different audiences, and one of them were the donors, and that the money being used, again, wasn't being used for what they said it was, but that it helped fund other activities. And I think it's going to be part of a theme we're going to see coming up for the other hearings, which is you need to follow the money and see how that money helped to fund the dissemination of disinformation and how we can then draw a line to that disinformation and how it was used to really rev up the protesters turned insurrectionists.
All right, let's talk about this memo that surfaced last week, from John Eastman. He is one of the president's lawyers who laid out that strategy for how Mike Pence and Republicans could stop the certification of the election. And he apparently himself didn't think that there was much to it in this email that was made public last week. And some on the president's team also thought that Eastman really, what he was doing was not sound, to put it mildly. What have we learned about Eastman and his role in this?
Well, I think that he provided these plans, which really weren't based in law. And in fact, to the extent that they tried to implement these plans were actively against the law, where he had these, you know, roadmaps for how to overturn the election. I think what we found is, again, there was no legal basis for trying to overturn the election. John Eastman couldn't find it. Nobody else could find it. And many in the Trump team were saying There is no there. There is no ability to move forward on this. Very similar to what we heard with respect to the political claims. John Eastman, of course, some of these emails are subject to a suit right here in California. And I think the more we learn about this, the more we hear, one, how unusual it was to continue the legal fight after December 14th, which is when those safe harbor provisions in the state kick in, basically saying, if you counted and you certified, that's it. And how actually close we came to unraveling all our election protections, but for a few people acting appropriately. And I think that's part of the push to reform things like the Electoral Count Act.
Jessica, always great to have you on for your analysis. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School and our regular Monday Legal Eagle here on Press Play. Coming up, the real estate boom in Paradise, where the state's deadliest fire on record leveled the town just 4 years ago. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Back in 2018, the town of Paradise pretty much burned to the ground in the campfire. It was California's deadliest wildfire on record. 85 people died. Nearly every home in the town was destroyed, and most of the surviving residents were homeless, scattered in camping trailers and community shelters nearby. Now, though, Paradise is experiencing a boom. Thousands of building permits have been granted. Some people who lost their homes have moved back. Others are moving there for the first time, even though the area is still at risk of another major fire. Joining us to talk about Paradise Found is Aaron Gordon, senior staff writer for Motherboard and Vice News. Hello.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, you toured Paradise. You went there. What does it look like now?
Well, I'm sure many Californians now know what an area that has been hit by a wildfire looks like. And that's pretty much what it looks like. You know, it looks like an area that a lot of trees are burned. A lot of lots are empty. There are a lot of, you know, remnants of burned tree stumps that have been removed. A lot of properties where you could tell a business used to exist, where now there's just like kind of a foundation. You know, it looks like an area that, frankly, something terrible happened in. I mean, that's at least the impression I got as I drove through it. But at the same time, you wouldn't say it's a devastated area or anything. You know, there's people who live there. There are businesses. There's commerce. There's lots of work being done. It's very active. So it's kind of in a weird transitional phase, I would say.
Right. But I imagine for many of the residents who had to flee and lost everything, returning back would just be filled with scary memories and potential trauma. I mean, they would maybe drive down streets where they remembered their friends and neighbors and the houses are vanished. So how are they coping with that if they are indeed returning?
I heard a lot of anecdotes of people who, when the fire first happened, swore they would never come back. You know, the thought, there's just no way after what they had been through that they could ever walk those streets again, ever be in Paradise. And to be sure, many of them really did leave and never come back, or at least have not come back yet. But a surprising number seem to have decided at some point for various personal reasons that they did want to come back. And people who swore they never would are now living there again, or, you know, looking at houses to buy there. So I think it's a very personal thing, a very personal decision. And even a lot of people are learning about themselves, you know, as they go through this process of what they really want and what they really value.
Well, what do they want? Why is Paradise attractive now?
The first thing to say is, you know, it's just an indisputably beautiful place. The lush greenery when you get outside of where the fire area was, which you don't have to drive for too far to get there, is gorgeous. You know, there are wonderful outdoor activities, hiking trails, biking, mountain biking. There's Paradise Lake, which, you know, when I was there, I happened to see a bald eagle fly overhead. And, you know, it's just like these little, you know, it's just
so it's living up to its name, in other words.
Exactly. You can see why people named it there. And, you know, the name has taken on so many ironic meanings in the recent years, but you can see maybe why someone at a certain time decided to name it that way. But the other reason is, you know, as I'm sure your listeners know, California is undergoing a housing crisis like many other areas in the country. And with all the building being done in Paradise, there's basically this inventory of new homes being created that isn't really matched by any other area in the country. And so for people looking for a place to live, they can find, you know, by California standards, even by, you know, the standards of most of the country, pretty affordable new homes to live in on decent sized lots in a place that's very desirable to live, honestly.
Well, what about the safety issues? As I understand it, there was one escape route, one road, really, and that was a big problem during the fire. Have they fixed that?
They haven't created any new escape routes that I'm aware of. I've heard of a couple of different stories about, you know, people went out various different ways at certain points of the fire, but there was like one main route that most people looked to go down that then became blocked for a while. I would say, generally speaking, any concerns that someone would have had, you know, if someone is concerned about living in Paradise from before the fire because of the wildfire risk, those concerns still exist.
Right. Well, I guess safe to say everyone is hyper aware of what could happen. Are they taking any steps to personally protect themselves? Like, are they making sure there's not a lot of brush around their property, or making sure that they know what the escape route is, or whatever it is, to try to protect themselves?
I think there's no one answer for the town as a whole or for the people moving there as a whole. From my reporting, I got a lot of different reactions from different people depending on really everything. Like, when you ask someone why they've chosen to live in a certain place, that's such a big question and often gets to some very fundamental views they have about, you know, their family and safety and what safety means to them, what risks really worry them. And a lot of that has to do with just based on their own life experience. Some people were saying, yes, you know, we're hyper prepared. We're doing all this work to make sure that our property is as safe as possible. We know exactly what we're going to do in a case of fire. Other people were the total opposite ends of the spectrum. Doesn't seem to concern them at all. And there were several people who kind of occupied middle ground in between, you know, trying to find some balance that worked for them that they thought was appropriate.
Right. What about the newbies, people who are moving in, some from out of state? You met a woman named Taylor Tanner, and she came to Paradise from Texas with her husband and small child. What does she say about the risk?
Yeah, she was, I would say, more towards the spectrum of someone who didn't really feel the need to do a whole lot to prepare for the possibility of a fire. And one commonality I did find among almost everybody who was moving to Paradise who had no real link to the town before the fire is they had experienced some kind of material loss before, whether it was a house fire, you know, not a wildfire, but just like a kind of more regular house fire, or whether it was a flood or another kind of natural disaster. And in Taylor's case, the family had to evacuate one home because of a flood, and they loaded all their possessions kind of into their truck and drove somewhere else. And then the truck got stolen, so they ended up losing everything anyways. And the way another person, Elizabeth Milbauer, explained it to me is once you've experienced something like that, where you lost all your material possessions, or you lost, you know, someone that's important to you, or something along those lines, the fear of it happening again can be lessened, is the way she characterized it for me. It's not as unknown. She now knows how she would react to a situation like that. And it doesn't seem as scary to her anymore as it used to. And I think Taylor was kind of similar, where she looked around at all the stuff she had in her house, and she kind of just thought, you know, if I lose all this stuff, that's fine, because I'm getting all of this wonderful experience living here with my family. And that's what's important to her.
I guess from a larger perspective, from a public policy perspective, many people in California are wondering if people should be allowed to move back to these areas, if it costs too much for all of us, because we all pay for this in one way or another, and whether or not there should be places that are just not meant for human beings to live in and they shouldn't live in them.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I think is most interesting when thinking about that issue is these towns like Paradise that exist on what's called like the urban wildlife interface, right? Where they're kind of neither totally urban areas, but neither are they like completely rural either. Like there's a main street with a grocery store and with a fire department and police services mm-hmm. and emergency services and all the things someone would expect with the conveniences of living in an urban area. But what people find so attractive about the area is that you can get a house that's set amongst trees where you don't see your neighbors and you get the kind of peace and serenity of rural living. You get both in a place like Paradise. And those are also the places that are most dangerous in wildfire situations because they have all the fuel to burn, but the population center to make it really devastating for so many people. And a lot of the measures that experts think would be best, like removing all this brush and a lot of the excess trees and putting houses closer together so there's not as much fuel. All these things require something that approaches an administrative state, right? Like you need inspections, you need, you know, a large government apparatus. And these are things that a lot of these people are moving to these areas specifically to avoid. Like you cut down all the trees so that there's no more kindling for a fire. Now you're just living in an urban area. Mm-hmm. So in trying to avoid a repeat, there's kind of the open question of, how do you save Paradise without destroying it? And should people be allowed to move back to areas like this? I think it's an even bigger question. It's, you know, should a certain lifestyle be permitted anymore if we're going to avoid something like this again and avoid the public cost of rebuilding these, you know, towns time and time again? It's a huge public policy question. And I mean, I don't pretend to know the answer, right? I mean, it's a really tough question.
Right. I mean, it's not, obviously not just there because the same year saw the fire in Malibu, and it's the same issue in wealthier areas as well. People want to live where they want to live.
Exactly. And people want to live in places for a ton of different reasons. And I think there's a lot of wishful thinking around the idea of like managed retreat, you know, that the government mm-hmm. can just like buy people out of really dangerous areas. I mean, there are so many examples of people who want to keep living in areas that are unsafe for various different reasons because it's their home, because it's somewhere that they feel emotionally attached to. And that emotional attachment can even occur if it hasn't been your home your entire life. I mean, the emotional attachment that these people are feeling to Paradise after having lived there for just a few months or a year was really startling to me. And that's something that I don't think it's going to change or go away. And I think the idea of, you know, people are going to leave areas because there's this kind of systemic natural disaster risk kind of flies in the face of what we see every day around the world.
Aaron Gordon, senior staff writer for Motherboard and Vice News, where you can read his article on the rebuilding of Paradise. Aaron, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Get your pencils out. We'll have some summer book recommendations for you.
It is totally absurd, right? And the author knows it, right? You can tell she's having fun writing this book, or at least it felt that way.
Fun reading for you. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, summer is finally upon us, and hopefully that means you will have a little time to unwind and maybe spend some time with a good book. We have some recommendations for you, and here with us is Jumana Khatib. She is editor and columnist for New York Times Books. Welcome.
Hey, Madeline. It's great to be here.
Great to have you. Okay, so first you brought us Trust by Hernan Diaz, who was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in Fiction in 2018 for his book In the Distance. So tell us what Trust is about.
Oh boy. Well, so Trust is a real jewel box of a novel, right? So ostensibly it's about a financier who he's born privileged, but gets really into the stock market in, you know, early 1900s New York. And he makes a killing. He's riveted by the stock market. This is all giving like Edith Wharton feeling and atmosphere and all that. And then before you know it, it's like 100 pages in, the book abruptly shifts perspective. You're in a whole new section, new characters, new premise, and it carries on that way for four sections. And this is a kind of a hard book to talk about. You just have to trust me here. But
yes.
Every single section will change what you think you knew previously. And it's remarkable. And I never thought that I would be gripped by a book that is ostensibly about the stock market. And I am riveted reading about stocks. And, you know, it is a very literary novel. The writing is beautiful. It's sly. And it's also very good about, you know, reminding us how money and fiction, which is not something you see a lot of. You don't see a lot of novels anymore that are dealing explicitly with money. Class, yes. All the sort of like fallout about economic despair and whatever, that's everywhere. But about money itself, he's making some really smart points about how that fits into fiction and storytelling and all that good stuff. And it's just beautifully structured so that the point that you are actually feeling like you're reading four different books. And I think that's also something that can be very satisfying if this is something you want to spend time with over a vacation or something, because it's almost like every time you have a new reading experience with the same book, it's going to be radically different.
Wow, that sounds really great. It sounds like this is something you could really get lost in for days on end.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I've Perfect gone summer MIA on my roof for days with this book. So,
all right. So that's Trust by Hernan Diaz. Next up, The Latecomer by Jean Hanf Korelitz. And tell us about this one.
Okay. So this is another really twisty literary family story. There is a family in Brooklyn Heights, not present day, and the wife, all she ever wanted was a family. And there's some infertility problems. Eventually, they end up with triplets. The triplets can't stand each other. and they're all in this beautiful townhouse in Borum Hill or Brooklyn Heights. The father is kind of emotionally absent, but he loves art collection. I mean, he is just driven by his art collection, you know. He's going down to the warehouses in Red Hook and like falling in love with modernist paintings. The wife, Johanna, is focused on creating a very happy family life, even though it seems as though she's the only one who's invested in this. There's a secret family. Everybody's kind of operating on their own plane. And then when the triplets go off to college, Johanna decides she's got one embryo, or at least one embryo, still on ice. And she decides, I'm going to have a fourth child 18 years after my triplets. And this child, of course, enters the mix and throws everything up into the air and becomes a very integral part of how this family's story gets told.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's amazing. It sort of suspends disbelief. But one thing
sounds a little soap opera-y, I have to admit.
Yes, I know. It sounds melodramatic. It's not, you know, you don't see like a boom mic hanging off the frame of the book, right? I mean, it is told, it's very smart, and she's a wonderful writer. And so Korelitz actually last year had a runaway breakout hit called The Plot, which was about a writer who steals the plot of a book of an acquaintance who has disappeared under mysterious circumstances and then is sort of racked by guilt. And she's actually really good about taking these scenarios that seem like they could be drippy or heavy-handed or, you know, just way too much. And she finds all the right moments for levity. She's very funny. She doesn't take it too seriously, but she delves into her character's emotions in really satisfying ways. You know, she really does her characters justice, even if you don't always like them. So yes, I would totally recommend this. And it's got a lot in common with Trust in the sense that you've got this kind of like mic drop midway through the story. And then at that point, all bets are off and you have no idea where it's going to go.
All right. Good to spend some time with a dysfunctional family when you're spending time with your own family this summer, perhaps.
The grass is always greener, right?
So. Right. And maybe browner here in California. But anyway, The Latecomer by Jean Hanf Korelitz or Korelitz. Mm-hmm. All right. You recommend a book that's coming out in July. So it's something to look forward to. It's called Carnality, a novel by Lena Wolf. Tell us about this one.
Yes. So Lena Wolf is a Swedish writer. This book of hers was translated by Frank Perry. And this is one, I mean, it can almost sell itself if you ask me. So it follows a Swedish writer who gets a grant to work and travel to Madrid. I think it's 3 months. And she decides to go to Madrid in the middle of the summer. It's miserably hot, oppressively hot. I mean, too hot to think. And the woman is really at a crossroads when we meet her. So she's just settled in Madrid. She gets to her apartment. She decides to go have a drink at a nearby bar. And she notices this man looking at her, really, you know, kind of trying to catch her eye. She ends up talking to him. He asks, why is Sweden so full of man haters? And which is an amazingly provocative thing to say in a bar. And so obviously things are not going well. And then somehow he ropes her into conversation. You know, she's alone. She's curious. She's a writer. She's trying to find her next subject. So her interest is piqued, even though he seems like one of the most abhorrent types of people you could find in a bar. Then he says, well, while I have you, is there any chance I could crash at your place for a couple of days? I'm running for my life. I'm on the lam. And she's saying, you've got to be kidding. There's no way. And he goes, no, no, no. I promise I can explain. Think it over. It's, you know, it's life or death. And she goes, well, who are you running from? And he says, a nun. Beautiful, beautiful premise. Hilarious setup. So it turns out that he has run afoul of a nun who is behind a reality TV show for couples in extremis where there's an element of marriage counseling or marriage therapy. But the nun is there to sort of make sure that all the parties are treated fairly and sort of help guide whatever kind of restitution or justice is needed to save the relationship or not. And he says, I had my doubts about going on this show. I knew it was kind of shtick, but I was desperate to stay in my marriage. And also, frankly, I thought that having a nun on the premises would add some legitimacy. And instead, now I'm running away from this nun who's put a bounty on my head, essentially. So from there, the story really spins out. But it's a good hook.
It sounds really fantastic.
Great.
It sounds funny, too.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I mean, it is totally absurd, right? I mean,
yeah.
And the author knows it, right? You can tell she's having fun writing this book, or at least it felt that way. But she uses this like totally absurd premise to actually make some very touching moments, like full of grace, funny, thought-provoking. It's great. No matter your feelings on nuns, Catholicism, marriage, I think you can find something in that. And so I totally recommend that.
Carnality, a novel by Lena Wolf. So that comes out in July. We'd have to pre-order that. Yeah. All right. So is there anything else that we haven't touched on, maybe a nonfiction book that you can recommend?
Oh, gosh. Yeah. I would be more than happy to talk about a memoir. It's called Also a Poet by Ada Calhoun. She's the daughter of Peter Sheldahl, who is a longtime art critic. He's written for The New Yorker. Mm-hmm. And he sort of has his own following, and he's very well entrenched.
Great.
He's wonderful. So Ada, she grew up in the East Village with Peter, and she was digging around in her childhood, you know, their building storage unit, and she finds a box of cassette tapes. And it turns out that these are recorded conversations between Peter and the poet Frank O'Hara, because Peter had it in his mind years and years and years ago that he wanted to write a biography of Frank. He loved Frank's poetry. I think his most famous poem is called Having a Coke with You. A lot of people read that at their wedding ceremonies anymore. Mm-hmm. I think Don Draper was a fan. I mean, so just to kind of put you in the mood.
Yeah.
And Ada also loved Frank O'Hara growing up. That was one of the things she and her father had in common, was that they were just in love with Frank's work. Now, Peter, in Ada's book, comes off as a very distant father, almost actively uninterested in his daughter, just totally absent. And so one day they're at a diner and Ada brings up the tapes and she says, Dad, like, I want to finish this project that you started. I know you ran into some trouble. I think Peter had some issues with Frank's family and like an authorized biography and whatever. And then he just kind of abandoned it. But Ada says, I really want to finish this. And so the book ends up being, it's not a straight biography of Frank by any stretch, but it's really like a chameleon of a book, right? Because you talk about Frank, she talks about her relationship with her father, as vexed as it is. And it's touching, it's moving, and she's very good about dealing with the, I mean, this is a difficult material, especially because Peter's quite ill at this point. So there is a sort of, it's not quite elegiac, but it's a real effort to work through the relationship and also give Frank his due, because he was never really celebrated during his lifetime. It's only been after his death that he's gotten some notoriety and some prominence.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. That's called Also a Poet.
Yes.
By Ada Calhoun. All right. Well, thank you. You've given us a lot to chew on for the summer. So that is wonderful.
I'm so delighted.
Thank you.
So delighted. Yes. It's so great to talk. I hope you find something you love to read.
Well, I think I just did. So thank you. Jumana Khatib is editor and columnist for New York Times Books. Well, speaking of summer, the Hollywood Bowl is planning a big Juneteenth concert this weekend. We'll talk with the conductor, Thomas Wilkins, about the Black composers he will highlight next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brandwell. This Sunday marks a historic moment for the Hollywood Bowl. For the first time, an all-Black symphony orchestra will fill the venue with music. It's called the Recollective Orchestra, and they are just one part of the event, Juneteenth, a global celebration of freedom, with performances by Earth, Wind & Fire, The Roots, Billy Porter, country star Mickey Guyton, and many others. Joining us now is one of the conductors for this weekend's performance, Thomas Wilkins. He is the principal conductor of the Hollywood Bowl Orchestra. Welcome back to Press Play.
Thank you. It's good to talk to you.
Great to have you back. All right, well, describe this concert. I just did a little, you know, a very cursory description, yeah. But what will this concert be?
This concert is a program of 1,000 moving parts. And what's what's really cool about it is that it crosses all genre. You know, the Recollective Orchestra and myself will be doing some classical music. Of course, and you already referenced Earth, Wind & Fire, Mickey Guyton. I mean, we're all over the map. And the beauty of that is it demonstrates how we as a people can participate in music at every level and in every genre.
And when you say we as a people, you mean Black people?
Yeah. Right.
Right. Okay. Black, well, let's folks. Talk about let's talk about the Recollective Orchestra, the classical part of this, because often that is not highlighted when it comes to Black music. And so here is a version of all the stars from the Black Panther film from the Recollective Orchestra.
Thank you.
Okay, so it's not a classical composition or performance. So tell us about this piece, and also in a broader sense, tell us more about the Recollective Orchestra.
Well, you know, I have never conducted this orchestra, which blows my mind, by the way. But, you know, it for us, for Black folks in classical music, there's so little degree of separation that I'm looking forward to seeing how many of those folks that I know from someplace else. I think the whole concept of putting all of those folks together to create an orchestra is exceptional. And, you know, that music may not be classical, but it's classic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's another demonstration. This is what we do at the Hollywood Bowl. I mean, at one moment we can play Stravinsky, and then we can turn around and play John Legend. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. and that's that kind of flexibility is something that's clearly in this Recollective Orchestra as well.
Yeah, I mean, I saw the Phil back Gwen Stefani the other night.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Right, right.
Well, so is this the first time you've led an all Black orchestra?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, with the possible exception of my junior high school orchestra uh-huh. back when I was growing up. But yeah, this is going to be, well, I say that, but in reality, I conducted for the 20th anniversary of the Sphinx Organization's concerto competition. And I believe that that orchestra was pretty much 100% Black and brown.
Hmm. Interesting. So yeah. How is it different for you then, being in front of an all Black orchestra?
It's not different. It's not different because for all of us, music is just music.
Right.
And it just so happens that everybody in the orchestra looks like me, which is an extreme rarity. But when it comes down to getting to work, we're all going to bring the same love and the same intensity and the same seriousness to music making. And I think, you know, probably to be fair to your question, there's probably something in all of us that's on the inside going, okay, this is really special. You know, I'm pretty sure that that sentiment is going to be present. But at the moment that it's time to get to work, we're all going to get to work.
Have you rehearsed?
We have not rehearsed. We will rehearse the day before and the day of, mm-hmm. and then we'll do the gig.
Okay.
Just like every other professional orchestra.
Of course. And then, so you'll find out how you feel about it at that first rehearsal, I guess.
Yeah, as I do with every orchestra I conduct,
you make
an assessment within the first 15 seconds and you go, okay, here we go. We got to do this.
Let's play some more music. This is, as I understand it, one of your favorite pieces. It's called Negro Folk Symphony, composed by William Dawson back in 1934. And here's a bit of that. That is from the second movement of Negro Folk Symphony, composed by William Dawson in 1934. Tell us what this piece means to you, why you like it so much.
What this piece represents, as Dawson himself would say, is he was essentially trying to recreate, or rather represent, what it felt like to be dislocated from your homeland and in bondage. And so he was giving us a glimpse of what the life of a slave was. It says that there, even in the midst of that bondage, there is still the presence of hope rather than despair. Despair is the last stage, I think, of hopelessness.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is a representation of a desire to be free and a representation of a desire to be whole and recognized as such.
Leopold Stokowski and the Philadelphia Orchestra premiered this, I understand.
Yeah, yeah. And, right? You know, Stokowski was a very ardent champion of African-American composers. You know, he did music of William Grant Still. He did music of Margaret Bonds, if I remember correctly. So it would come as no surprise that he would do this, that he would take on this work.
And he was the founder of the Hollywood Bowl Symphony Orchestra.
Okay, now you just educated me.
So in a way, you're connected that way as well.
Yes, Deb, I love it.
All sorts of connections. Well, you mentioned the composer Margaret Bonds, and let's play another piece, this one from her.
Oh, good.
This one is called Montgomery Variations. Montgomery Variations by the composer Margaret Bonds, and she composed this in 1964 during the Civil Rights Movement. Tell us more about her and this composition.
Yes, she was very inspired by Martin Luther King's March for Civil Rights, and that's where this piece gets its inspiration. You know, one of the things that when I was young, the grown-ups in my life said that basically in the midst of injustice, we really only had two weapons. One was our feet and the other was our voice. We used our feet to march and in protest, and we used our voice to speak out. But that generation also used their voice and their voices to pray. And what's significant about that is that that was one of the things that happened at the original Juneteenth, is that there was lots of celebration, of course, but there was also lots of prayer. For me, this piece speaks to not only the essence of Juneteenth, almost like the Dawson, so this idea of where hope comes from.
And she was one of the most prominent and few Black women composers.
Yeah, she, I think of her, and I think of Julia Perry, and I think of Florence Price is the third mm-hmm. person that I think of. Yeah, these were women who were finding a way and making a way. You know, when Florence Price, for example, wanted her piece to be performed by a professional orchestra, she said, listen, I got two strikes against me. One, I'm Black, and the other, I'm a female. But they still believed something good about themselves and about the work that they were doing. And Margaret Bonds falls into that category of people who just figured out how to persevere. You know, I say to young Black musicians now, when they meet me, they want to know, How do we survive this career journey that we're on? And I said, it's not a matter of survival, it's a matter of navigating. And Margaret Bonds was a person just like Florence Price who figured out how to navigate.
Hmm. And thrive. I mean, also right. Thrive, right? And not just navigate.
Right, right.
Well, you certainly have in your career.
I have. And I said, if I ever get around to writing my memoirs, maybe the title is going to be No One's More Surprised Than I Am. But
well, it's just a delight having you on the show, a delight watching you conduct at the Bowl each summer. And thank you for coming back. I know you don't even live in LA. You live in Indiana.
Right.
So thank you for making the journeys back and forth.
Yeah, I live in Indiana. I live in Florida. I live on an airplane.
Well, okay. You're going to live in Hollywood at the Hollywood Bowl this Sunday, Juneteenth, a global celebration of freedom. It takes place that night at the Bowl. If you can't make it, you can also watch it on CNN. Thomas Wilkins is the principal conductor of the Hollywood Bowl Orchestra. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's always great to talk to you. Take care.
And that does it for us today on Press Play. Thank you for listening. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you tomorrow.